want to call a roll and make sure we're all, everyone's here?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Flowers?
Present.
Dr. Bohansky?
Present.
Dr. Davy?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Gill?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
All board members are present.
All right, thank you. All right, I'd like to look at the agenda real quick. The next item is informal interviews, but we also have several individuals waiting for items that are further down on the agenda, which I would like to just, I think, skip to and focus on them for a minute, let them go where they need to afterwards, or they can stay and listen if they'd like. So if we could move to maybe item executive director, is it 17, you think, starting there, and then to 17 and 18, 19?
This is Jean Galvin, possibly 18 first.
Okay, that's fine. So let's do 18, discussion, consideration, and possible action on the following applications for licensure pursuant to ARS 324202. Executive Director, would you like to provide an overview?
Pardon me, yes. This matter was placed on the agenda primarily at the suggestion of Ms. Galvin, and I know she'd like to speak to that. But in terms of background for these particular application files, these four applicants were previously considered by this board, and at the time, just prior to that consideration, you'll remember that Governor Doug Ducey's office issued the executive order that stipulated that if a licensing board intended to deny a license to applicants applying under the universal recognition statute, if that was the board's stated intent, then the board was to supply that information to the governor's office. So the board rendered that decision on February 13th. The following week, those materials were submitted to the governor's office, and we have not received any response to those submissions. So these applications are still in that status, if you will, and so they're being brought back to the board for your consideration.
This is Jean Galvin, and Heidi did a nice job kind of summarizing where we are. We have this handful of applicants who applied under universal recognition, and the board had made some preliminary determination, or at least articulated some preliminary concerns that they had about their applications, whether they didn't take the ECCC but passed another exam, or perhaps their doctoral degree wasn't from an regionally accredited university. But based upon the board's interpretation of universal recognition statute at that time, the board had determined that even though these individuals were licensed in another state, their practice level in that state would not be equal to a person holding licensure in Arizona. In this current legislative session, Senate Bill 1212 was introduced, and that bill made revisions to the universal recognition statute that, it could be argued, directly impacted the board's interpretation of universal recognition statute. Looking at the legislative history of 1212, the bill made it out of both houses and I believe was scheduled for a third reading, but then COVID-19 happened, and I believe the reports were that the Senate was going to adjourn today, although the House, I understand it, is not going to adjourn. So that leaves these four or five universal recognition applications out there, just kind of hanging out there. And I thought it was in the best interest of those applicants who are wondering about the status of their applications and the board to kind of determine whether we are, what we're going to do with these applicants.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. Thank you, Judge.
Okay, and I am available for executive session, although I know that that's kind of clunky and complicated. But if the board does have questions and seeks legal advice on those four applicants, then we can go ahead and do that.
All right. I guess I do have a question. It's not really legal. Maybe Executive Director, you can answer is, and this universal recognition executive order from the governor's been in effect now for a while now. How are the other boards, are they interpreting it as a direct across the, you know, board kind of approving their applications?
Yes, Madam Chair. My understanding is that the other boards are not seeing applications presenting the same sort of elements that, you know, this board has reviewed and discussed quite extensively. So other boards are not reporting to me, to each other that I'm aware of having denied any universal recognition applications so far. They do speak in terms of, you know, in hypotheticals, if a certain situation presented, you know, perhaps that their boards would be compelled to issue a denial, but I'm not hearing of anything that is congruent to sort of what this board has been presented with and has had to address.
All right. Board members, any thoughts on these applications? Dave? You know, I'll share my thoughts. I think wasn't excited about maybe how the executive order and how it relates to us, but I think the reality is, and we also received that memo from the governor's office of, you know, their interpretation, and I think based on their interpretation and based on the Senate Bill 1212, if it had passed, you know, these would be approved.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Flowers.
Yes, looking at my, you know, reading through the new law, it appears that these individuals would be eligible for Arizona licensure, even though without that legislation, we argued that they don't. And I think the questions the board had were pretty well addressed in the legislation.
Just to be clear, Dr. Flowers, Senate Bill 1212 has not passed both houses, was not signed by the governor. I will suggest that it was well on its way, and then COVID-19 happened. But I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. 1212 is not new law. It was proposed.
Okay, so what we saw previously that said, we don't care what Arizona's, I'm kind of paraphrasing, we don't care what Arizona policy and statutes say. If other states that they're good enough for us. That one apparently is not really signed off on then.
That's a rough paraphrase of what 1212 is. It is not law. But for COVID-19, I'm fairly certain that it would be.
Okay. So I'm wondering if
this is all talking around the issue.
Okay, wait. Dr. Bohansky, Dr. Flowers is finishing. Go ahead, Dr. Flowers.
Oh, so I'm not clear why we're reviewing these with that not having been fully done.
I think part of it was that our committee has interpreted the law in a way maybe other committees haven't, and so I think we wanted to revisit it, knowing that there's a Senate bill that most likely would have gone through if it hadn't been for the COVID-19. Dr. Bohansky.
The new Senate bill doesn't address the issue that's where with it. We have two concerns. Or not is not going to fix that.
Dr. Borjanski, you're cutting out.
Yes, we can't hear you. Can't hear you, Dr. Borjanski. Dr. Bob, I can't hear you. Are you on mute?
Looks like he's trying to call back in.
Okay. Does anyone else have a comment while we're waiting for Dr. Bob? Dr. Malott, was that you? Great. Yep.
Well, can we wait a minute so Dr. Bohansky can hear the discussion, please?
All right. Thank you. I guess I'll take this moment just to thank everybody for your patience with this whole Zoom and phone process. The meeting's important. We want to keep moving, but I know that this is a new method for all of us, and I do appreciate all of your patience.
Krishna, can you tell us Dr. Bob is back? He seems to be indicating.
Turn me on. Thank you.
Thank you.
I got kicked out.
You were last saying that the new Senate bill doesn't address the issue. You said there are two concerns, and that's when we lost.
Yes. There are two significant concerns, and they are significant. Concern number one, does this graduate coming out of a doctoral program have to graduate from a university that's recognized and accredited as a university? Yes or no? Not some fly-by-night thing, something that doesn't, we have required regional accreditation as all universities, doesn't matter who they are. Walden or ASU or U of A or Argosy, they got to be an accredited university. That's what the Department of Education says for getting student loans and yada, 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 because that's a minimum qualification that there's a faculty and a library and a course of study. Not talking APA, just basic university accreditation. Should you have to come from an accredited university? Why do we have that? A whole lot of these online degree things and make up your mom and pop university things have popped up all over. Is it possible for someone to come in under Universal? Yeah, there was a small donut hole in California where they accredited universities based upon their Department of Education standards, not by regional accreditation. California fixed that. They got rid of it, but there are several people who got licensed that way, not from a real accredited university. That's number one. Should you have to come from accredited university? Number two, every jurisdiction in North America, save one, the 64 jurisdictions in North America have agreed that you have to take the national boards. We have students right now here sitting in Arizona who would be a psychologist today if we didn't have that license or that requirement for our license. You have to pass the damn board. That's a minimum standard. Puerto Rico doesn't have that as a standard. So you can get a license there without passing the national boards. We have always had that as a standard. We've never licensed either of those criteria if someone didn't have it. You don't come from a real university,
an accredited university, we don't consider your application. If you don't pass the boards, you can't get your license. Those are the issues. 1212 doesn't address either of them.
So, Dr. Borjanski, just so I'm clear, you're stating your opinion that you don't believe Senate Bill 1212, although it hasn't passed, as drafted, doesn't address the two concerns about the accredited university and the taking and passing of the ACCC.
Correct.
Because we're talking in very general terms about agenda item 18 and those four, you know, applicants in general.
Yes, I'm talking in general.
Okay.
I think anyone should be able to apply for a license. And we can have all kind of requirements as all the states do. And I fully support the governor's idea of universal licensure. I wish every state would have it. And I wish we'd have an agreed upon standard. And in fact, that's what the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards is for. They gave us an agreed upon standard. What's the very minimum of that standard? A doctoral degree. From where? An accredited university. What's the second standard? You pass the boards. Now, states have added every other Tom, Dick, and Harry thing you can imagine. You must come from an APA school. You must come from this. You must come from that. You must do this. You must do that. If we throw all the frills and all the special interest things away, what are the two basics? Doctoral degree from an accredited university. That's a big deal. That's why we have people like Dr. Ramona and Dr. Meyer who can look at a transcript and say, yes, that's from a real university. We got the book here. We can look it up from whatever country or whatever state they come from, and we can tell you if that's an accredited university. And if they got that, I'm good. That's first criteria. Second criteria, ask the exam. That's all we ask. Now, we have the danger of a loophole in our universal licensing piece where folks coming from, in specific, Puerto Rico, no other jurisdiction, Canadian or United States, licenses anybody without passing the exam. Puerto Rico does. So applicants from Puerto Rico pick up an Arizona license without passing the exam. Second, there is a small number of students who were in California during the days in which California kind of thought they knew best and you didn't need regional accreditation. If you got accredited by the California Department of Education, that was good enough. And there was a specific reason for that. And the board in California put their foot down and said, hey, look, our people aren't getting licensed in any other state.
He's dropped off again. Krishna, do you see him dialing in?
Krishna also got bumped out of the call, so she's rejoining.
No, I'm here.
Thank you for releasing me.
I'm here, Heidi. That was Jennifer.
I was dropped again. I'm back. And my last statement there was that California, on a whole, there are no longer people coming to universities that were not accredited and went out of business and flopped as universities. But there are several people they licensed in that. That's an issue when we run across one of those applications.
Would, given the status of those four applicants and applications in number 18, and the pendency of Senate Bill 1212, does the board deem it advisable to have an executive session for legal advice?
Say that again?
Do you guys want to go into executive session for legal advice?
Oh, God.
Yes.
Yes.
Should we just call in, given the trouble last time?
Yes, all right, please, so we're the number I emailed earlier.
Okay, so that's everyone be sure to cover your camera lens, whatever. Hang up off of this phone that you called in for Zoom.
Okay.
And Heidi emailed us earlier a telephone number for executive session. Please use that number on another phone and pick up and call executive session.
Dr. Gill, did you get that phone number? Dr. Gill?
Did we have a vote?
No.
What is that?
Dr. Gill?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to. Can someone test it? I need to have a vote to go into executive session
for legal advice.
For legal advice. So I don't. Do I see enough people on to have a vote? I don't think I do. I think we're a little bit too. Let's see, people. All right, so. Can someone go into exec session and ask them to please exit and come back for me to vote?
Yeah, Jennifer's the moderator for executive session, so she can go in and tell those folks to hang up and come back.
Okay, I'll just wait here. But Dr. Gill, don't go anywhere yet. We need a vote to go in. Thank you. And Heidi, can you text Dr. Gill the phone number? He doesn't have it.
Certainly.
All right, thank you. Dr. Gill, do you have your phone with you? Your cell phone?
No.
Okay, you'll receive a text in just a minute. Heidi, were you able to get hold of Jennifer?
Okay, I thought she heard me. I will text her. Hold on.
Okay, we got Dr. Malott back. Dr. Flowers there. I'm missing two more.
Dr. Davies.
Dr. Davies is back. Guys, I need a couple more.
Dr. Myers here.
Dr. Myers. I think I need a few more. Oh, there's Dr. Davis Wilson. And I just need Dr. Bohansky. I think there's a doctor. Mr. Diner, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
All right. In our excitement to get legal counsel, we forgot to go, and we need a vote to go into executive session. So I'm going to make a motion that we go into this executive session to get legal advice. Do we have a second?
Seconded.
We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Now, everybody hang up, cover your cameras, and let's go into this session. I think we're waiting for a few more people. Dr. Flowers, are you there?
Yes.
We can't see you. You may want to fix your camera. Adjust.
Okay.
There's Dr. Bohansky. Dr. Bohansky back. Dr. Davis.
I think Dr. Gill needs to turn his camera on.
All right, are we all here?
Yeah.
Dr. Bohansky, are you here? I don't see him.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Dr. Davis Wilson, are you there?
I'm here.
Mr. Diner? Oh, there he is.
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Ms. Lowe, you want to just do a roll call real quick and make sure we're all here?
Sure, Madam Shreve. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Flowers?
Present.
Dr. Bohansky?
Here.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Gill?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
All board members are present.
All right, thank you, Ms. Ho. All right, so we're discussing item 18 regarding universal recognition applications that we received. Again, let's continue discussion. Any discussion from our board members?
Yes, reviewing the four applicants, I think we've examined the before, and with the universal recognition legislation, it appears that in spite of some issues that, you know, they would not have been qualified with their regular licensing application, but with this new policy, it appears that they are all eligible for licensure, and I make a motion that they be approved for licensure.
All right, we have a motion to approve licensure for the four applications. Is there a second?
A second.
And for the record, the items 18A through D, Aldo Rivella, James Willis, Jude Miller-Burke, and Zadea Garcia. I'm not going to try the other name. Okay.
Yelly.
So, all right. So we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? A roll call hearing. If there's no, when it's time for a roll, have a roll call. Okay, Dr. Bohansky, did you have a comment?
No.
Okay. You know, I'll make a comment, although sometimes you're not necessarily thrilled with the laws or, you know, the outcomes. It is what it is, and we're here to support them. I do feel, you know, I do feel that we need to follow through with what I think the intent of the universal recognition was. I know there's some concerns about the situation, but I think moving forward goes along with the intent of the laws. Any other comments? All right, are we gonna do, a roll call vote?
Yes, please.
All right, Ms. Poe?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Treves?
Yes.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes.
Dr. Bohansky?
No.
Dr. Davy?
No.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Malott?
Yes.
We have 7 yays, 2 noes, motion carries.
All right, thank you. I want to move to item number 17, discussion and consideration of possible actions following applications of licensure pursuant to ARS 324302. Carol Gandolfi, representing our committee is Lynn Evans from the Attorney General's office. Ms. Evans, are you on the line?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, great. Welcome. And also, I believe Ms. Gandolfo, are you present? Dr. Gandolfo, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Her attorneys are present, or at least they have been. We should call for John Richard and for Larry Cohen.
Mr. Ritchie or Mr. Cohen?
Yeah, are this you? Is John Richard. Can you hear me?
All right. I can, yeah. I just wanted to get, I don't know if you wanted to say a few words before as an introduction.
It's unclear to me what the question is before the board, apart from the application, but I'd be happy to speak to the application.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at is the application. And typically we'll give the applicant an opportunity. Did you have anything to say in regards to Dr. Gandolfo?
Yes, it remains our view, as it has all along, that Dr. Gandolfo is eligible for licensure under ARS 324302. It also appears as though the board has made the determination that under existing law and proposed legislative changes, applicants in the same position or similar positions as Dr. Gandolfo are also eligible for licensure. I will note that at the time she applied for licensure, she was given an opportunity to withdraw the application. She determined not to and to appeal it. So unclear to me why she would be treated differently than the other applicants that were approved for licensure. But happy to speak to any of the board's concerns regarding those matters, if any.
All right, thank you for your comments. All right, board members, is there any discussion regarding the application? Is there a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I also make a motion that Dr. Gandolfo, application for licensure be approved.
We have a motion for approval and a second. Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
Can we get a roll call vote on this? I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Yes, that's, all right, Ms. Poe, could you do a roll call vote, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes.
Dr. Bohansky?
No.
Dr. Davy?
No.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Malott?
Yes.
We have 7 yeses, 2 noes. Motion carries.
This is Jean Galvin on behalf of the state. I'm assuming that your motion to grant Dr. Gandolfo's application for universal recognition implies that your denial would be vacated. It's the state's request that Mr. Ritchie's and Mr. Cohen then would withdraw the appeal of the denial.
Are you asking us if that's,
they're on the line. I'm wondering if they would withdraw their appeal and then their request, the petition that they filed under Title 41.
Yes, in light of the, thank you. Yes, in light of the board's approval of the application, we would withdraw that petition.
Yes,
and your appeal?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ritchie, Mr. Cohen.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Do we need a motion to rescind the board's previous decision to deny licensure?
Ms. Galvin?
This is Lynette. I don't think you do. I think that motion was quick in the clarification from Ms. Galvin about the status.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is Dr. Gill. Yes. I'm recused in this case, and so I'll have to change my vote from yes to abstain.
Oh, okay. So that's good. All right. With that recusal, that's then, Ms. Poe, my count is 6 yeses, 2 noes, and 1 abstain.
That is correct.
Okay. So motion still carries. Thank you for bringing that up so we put it in the minutes. Okay. Moving on, I'd like to move on then to item number 20. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding behavior analyst applications for licensure submitted by Leah Sparrow. Ms. Boat?
Thank you, Ms. Shreve. Dr. Shapiro has submitted an application for behavior analyst licensure, which was reviewed by the CBA on May 1st. At that time, the CBA had reviewed the verification of supervised experience or independent field work, and it was noted that her supervisor, Dr. Sundberg, was not board certified, BCBA certified at the time of the supervision, which was from 2004 to 2006, and he obtained BCBA certification in 2008, and so the committee had felt that Dr. Shapiro did not meet the requirements in R4-26-404.2, where it says that a supervisor must be BCBA certified. Subsequent to that meeting, new information came forward where in R4-26-404.2A, it states that that particular section, the supervision requirements, does not apply to those who completed their supervised experience before January 1st, 2015. And therefore, because she did do her 1,500 hours as required under the statute, 32-2091.03, I believe, that it's up to the board to determine if then, in fact, she does meet licensure requirements. And that is my summary.
All right. So based on, I think what I'm hearing, Ms. Oak, is that you believe she does meet it based on that she was basically grandfathered in before this law?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Do we need a motion to approve it then?
Madam Chair, if I may, I want to address two things. One, I am aware and would be in agreement with moving forward with the approval. One, because she was grandfathered in, and two, because prior to 2009, actually prior to 2012, CACB had some different standards for some ABAI-approved supervisors. And so I think that given the way that the rule is written, I would be in agreement with it. Now, during the committee review of the application, and it was actually, I was the lead on this, and it was actually my mistake that you know, we were able to later catch in review of the rule. But in the committee, there were three different just clerical issues on her application. And so I would just ask that I would be in support of moving forward with approval of the application, but I would still like board staff to reach out to the applicant and correct the, we have all the correct information. It's just that there are clerical errors that I would like to have corrected for the record.
Are they substantial errors where they make a difference?
They do not. There's two, one of which I think the date of her matriculated grad school start date is just difficult to read. The other is that she lists her grad certificate date as graduated in 2006. However, her transcript was a different date. The third one is that she did answer yes to question number five, or on page number five, question number 19, which states that she did complete 270 hours. Her transcripts do not reflect that, and the rule does not require it for an applicant in her position. So an answer of no is sufficient to move her application forward, but it does need to be accurate to reflect her transcript.
I'm not sure I feel comfortable. I know, Ms. Galvin, I bet if we're approving an application that doesn't have the correct information, it seems like it should have been corrected before it came to the board. I don't know. I would just turn to Ms. Malott. I know she does a lot of this with the psychology portion of it. Is if there's errors on the application that are significant we need to change, is that something we approve and ask them to change after the fact?
I think you would want a complete application.
Here's something we can recommend. We can kind of recommend it pending those changes to the application. So as soon as we get it, then it can move forward. So,
okay, so we don't have that. Is that okay with you, Ms. Galvin?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So I'd make a motion that we approve the application with the based on once we receive. Approve the application based upon receiving an updated, amended application with the aforementioned items by Dr. Davis Wilson.
I would second that.
We got a motion and a second. Any discussion?
Just to verify, this is just Dr. Malott. I just wanted to say, if we are not sure about a requirement, then we would. You know, we would send it back for additional information. If it's just, and we know it's a clerical error, we often say get it corrected and then move it forward. So,
okay. All right. Any other discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposing? I don't think anybody approving from this? Okay. All right, let's then move back to, I think those are the only ones that have people involved. Let's move back to item 11, which is the informal interview. And what I would like to do is I am going to, there's certain verbiage we use for the informal interviews. I'm going to introduce it. I'll present all of the different complaints, all the alleged violations by complaint number, and then we will have each of the lead, Dr. Bohansky and Dr. Flowers, provide a brief summary of the cases that they are the leads on. So let me go ahead and start. The time now is 4:08 on March 13, 2020. This is the formal interview of Dr. John Denbor, K-1 case number 1825, 1826, 1902, and 1904. And Dr. Denbor, you're here with your attorney, and you have legal counsel today, correct?
That is correct.
All right. My name's Ms. Shreve. I'm the chair of the board. The other board members and the board staff will introduce themselves. If we could introduce ourselves. Go ahead. Dr. Flowers. This will be interesting.
Dr. Flowers, psychology member.
Thank you. Dr. Myers, just jump in there.
Dr. Myers, the academic board member.
Thank you.
Dr. Davey.
Thank you.
Dr. Davey, behavior analyst.
Dr. Malott.
Dr. Malott, psychologist board member.
Mr. Brenner,
public board member.
Thank you, Mr. Dr. Gill.
Psychologist board member.
Dr. Meyer, I think Dr. Bohansky.
Psychology board member.
Okay, is that everybody? Dr. Davis Wilson, did you? Okay, these proceedings are being audio taped, so everyone must introduce themselves, which they did. And we also have present Ms. Galvin, who is our board attorney. You've been noticed of the matters to be discussed today and the possible actions the board may take in the informal interview. The purpose of this informal interview is to inquire into the facts and circumstances of the case. Board members have read all the material and any additional submissions. If it is necessary to refer to clients or patients during the interview, please do so by initials only. I will read the allegations from the informal interview notice, and then we will interview you. If present, the complainant may address the board after we interview the licensee. So the alleged allegations for complaint number 1825 are ARS 32-2061-16-0, ARS 32-1621-16-DD, ethical standards adopted by the board pertain to section 9.01. Case number 1826, the alleged allegations are ARS 32-2061-16A, 32-2061-16C, ARS 32-2061-16E, ARS 32-6116H, 16O, and 16DD pertain to section 6.04. Case number 1402, the alleged allegations are ARS 32-2061A, O, and that's it on that one. And then on case number 1904, alleged allegations are ARS 32-2061-16A, H, O, P, double D with the sections pertaining to 3.05. I would now ask Dr. Denbor, I now swear you in. Do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the whole truth?
I do.
All right, Dr. Denbor, did you review the records in the cases in preparation for your appearance here today?
Yes, I reviewed the records.
All right, and do you wish to make any opening statements in regards to, I'd like to take these one at a time just because we have to do a summary, 1825.
Would you like Dr. Bohansky to do the summary first of 1825?
That would be great. Dr. Bohansky, would you like to provide a summary?
Sure.
this case, we have a complaint filed by KC. KC is an individual who suffered a work-related injury back in 2015. It resulted in a potential mild traumatic brain injury. She was initially treated at Banner Medical System, and her physician, Dr. Eckstein, ended up referring her to Dr. DeBoner, and it was as a result of symptoms that she presented, in which she was concerned and wanted a neuropsychological assessment. Following that assessment, the complainant reports that Dr. DeBoner did not act with professionalism throughout the treatment or evaluation process, that he lacked professionalism. His report and assessment was not accurate, and his reports had numerous errors. She reported that her post-injury symptoms and challenges at work were essentially ignored, and that discussion of test results from her neuropsychological evaluation were full of inconsistencies. The impressions presented by Dr. DeBoner and essentially the diagnostic impression was unsubstantiated. She was portrayed as having lied in her initial interview. When asked about her affect, depression, anxiety, and later having revealed a history that she did not have, as there were many misrepresentations in the document, and that was used by her doctor, and most importantly by her workers' compensation firm, to make critical decisions about her health status. She believes that the doctor, in the evaluation process, ignored or was confused by her test results. She thinks that doctor did not take her seriously, and that he had a responsibility to her, and he did not meet his professional responsibilities in her evaluation, which essentially summarizes her concerns.
Ms. Poe, do we know if the complainant is on the line? Ms. Michelson, was she calling in?
Yeah, I am on the line, yes. Mm-hmm. Hello, yes, I'm on the line.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Shreve, are you on the line?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm on the line, thanks. Casey? If would you like to make a statement? Great.
I would, yes. Thank you. Yeah, good afternoon.
Could you swear her in, please, Ms. Shreve?
Yes, Ms. Casey, do you swear to say the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
I do, yes.
All right, thank you. And again, thank you for being here today. Go ahead with your opening comments.
Okay, thank you. I was referred for a neuropsychological evaluation when I asked my doctor at the Banner Concussion Center to address the challenges I was having doing my job after being injured. I consented to take a day off work to be tested by Dr. John Denborn with the understanding that he would look for an answer for me. I took the evaluation very seriously. When Dr. Denborn interviewed me, I described how my work skills had changed since the injury. He recommended that I have speech and language therapy followed by another round of testing. I agreed, and he initiated the referral. But in his report, he did not document my descriptions of what I was experiencing, his own recommendation, or the referral. In fact, he did not address the reason I was evaluated at all. Dr. Denborn wrote reports filled with inaccurate, inconsistent, and unsubstantiated statements. I will touch on five examples now. One, in the first report, he described me as cooperative and courteous in the first testing session and said my test scores were valid indicators. But in the second report, he made a claim that the first evaluation had not been valid because I had not been cooperative. That statement was false. Two, although I told Dr. Denborn it was hard for me to work even 40 hours a week, he repeatedly said I was working 60-plus hours a week. Three, multiple times in the second and third reports, he said I had been in speech and language therapy and had benefited from it. But I was at a meeting with Dr. Denborn just 2 hours before the reports were generated and told him I had not started speech and language therapy. Clearly, I had not benefited from it. Four, he claimed there had been a follow-up interview in which I made a revelation about my history. Actually, there was no follow-up interview. I did not have the history he described, and I did not tell Dr. Denborn that I did. Five, he speculated that I may have an extreme perception of my injury. I gave Dr. Denborn facts, not perception. The facts were important to me. I thought they would point to my answer. Dr. Denborn's reports are not factual. They are not objective. He did no real analysis of the test results. He did not address the matter at hand. Instead, he painted a picture of me that was unlike me and was baseless. His claims were not supported by facts or data. I believe his misrepresentation of me, as seen in the reports, undermined my request for medical attention. After the sessions with Dr. Denborn, I had to keep working as if my health and skills were intact. The specialties I needed were on the Banner Concussion Center team, but I was not referred for other types of evaluations. So I got my answer 1 year later outside the Banner system. I learned that I was right. The difficulty doing my work was the outcome of physical conditions caused by the injury. And those conditions could have been treated right away and managed if I had been taken seriously. When I was diagnosed, the doctor asked me, "You're not trying to work like this, are you?" Of course, I had tried to work like that. I had no choice. I kept trying until I lost my job. Because when I went to my doctor for help, for that reason, he referred me to Dr. Denborn. I believed that the evaluation was a search for answers, but it was not. Dr. Denborn ignored the facts, he did no analysis, and he wrote inaccurate, inconsistent, unsubstantiated reports that made my situation worse. Thank you for addressing my complaint, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you for being with us today. I appreciate it. Board members, do you have any questions for Casey?
Yes, Madam Clerk.
I'm sorry, I think I heard Dr. Bohansky first, and then I heard someone else. Go ahead, Dr.
Casey,
Bohansky.
Casey, thank you for coming today. Could you give me a sense of how you ended up getting the right answers?
It was an occupational therapy evaluation that actually pointed out that what my real condition was that I needed to have treated.
Okay. And how is it that you arrived at an OT evaluation?
I arrived at that because I had a neuropsychological evaluation by a different doctor as a function of a legal action I was in, and he was concerned about some of the things he saw that had been previously seen, but he felt they needed to be followed up on, and so he said that I should have that occupational therapy evaluation, and that's
what was it that the second psychologist found that the first one did not?
But we can't do any type ma'am, we can't give any kind of diagnosis or anything in public meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, just want to clarify. Thank you.
Do you want me to say anything, or?
No diagnosis.
Not answer that question?
No diagnosis.
Okay, right. Okay, no problem.
So, Dr. Bohansky, can you rephrase it, or is it a...
What about you did he discover mm-hmm. that you didn't find in the first evaluation?
I would have to give you the specific name of the test. Do you want me to do that? It's okay. The PEG test. It was when he did the PEG test for me, moving the pegs over.
Okay.
And he was concerned about something that he observed there, yes.
All right. And in the process of that evaluation, he referred you for occupational therapy assessment?
Yes.
And any other treatment?
No.
Okay. And the speech therapy you did prior to that, was that something you continued with?
I was in speech therapy a number of sessions. I would have to look to see exactly how many sessions I did, yes.
Was that helpful?
It was helpful. It was the cognitive therapy especially was helpful, as well as the speech therapy and the learning of the strategies for doing things that I needed to do differently after being injured. It's not strictly treatment. It doesn't, I didn't see it as a cure, but it did helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It was helpful for coping, yes.
So the cognitive mm-hmm. treatments and their speech therapies, treatments that you went through after Dr. DeBonner's evaluation was helpful for you?
Yes, I started it 3 days after my last session with him, and yes, I would say it was helpful. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you. Any other questions from the board members?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Flowers.
Another question. I'm unclear, maybe you touched on this in your statement. There are some practitioners, I'd say many, that will ask you about your history of complaints, history of what's going on, to include symptoms that might be distress of any kind and work issues and so forth. Was that done as part of this evaluation?
When he interviewed me, I did share with him the changes in my ability to do my work, the way that it was different from prior to when I was injured. And I was concerned that it didn't seem like that was getting better. So that was why I wanted to be evaluated by whatever the right evaluation might be, and to determine if there was something else that was not yet identified that could be treated. But I did tell Dr. Denboy that, yes, I explained it to him. I believe that's why he recommended the speech and language therapy, although he did not say so in his report.
Okay, and anything as far as, did he talk to you about any kind of mental health issues?
Well, when he interviewed me, he asked me about my history, and I remember him asking me if I had any history of emotional issues or a similar question, and I said no. And he said depression or anxiety, and I said no. That was the only time we talked about my history.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Casey, I got a question for you. Could you just, what was the time frame of this appointment when you met with Dr. Denbor?
My first appointment with him was on November 13th. I went back for the second on December 8th. Originally, he had wanted me to, 2015.
Okay.
Yeah, he originally had wanted me to go into speech and language therapy first before coming back, but my approval was delayed, and then he was leaving Banner, so I was not able to do that.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions from the board members? Okay, at this point, if Dr. Denbor or Mr. Reeves have any questions for the complainant, you can address those to me, and if I feel they're appropriate, then I will address them to the case to Casey.
We don't have any questions of Casey.
All right. Casey, I'd just like to thank you for being here today. We're going to continue on with this discussion, but thanks for coming forward and for chatting with us.
Okay, thank you.
Great. So, do we have any questions for Dr. Denbor?
Ms. Shreve,
we never got a chance to make our introductory comments.
Yeah. I'd like to make an introductory comment if possible.
All right, thank you. All right, my first time doing this one, so I do apologize. All right, Mr. Eves or Dr. Denbor, if you'd like to make a comment.
This is Mr. Eves.
I'll let Mr. Eves go first. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So we certainly sympathize with Casey, and nothing that I say intends to diminish the process she's been through. The only thing that I'll point out is this is a process that started in 2015 with her first appointment, and the report that was written in this case was written well before Dr. Denbor was placed on probation and assigned to work with a practice monitor, Dr. Toma. So we've talked about this plenty today, but I think that this is one of those cases, and I've said this since the beginning, that this complaint came in as John was finishing his practice monitoring with Dr. Toma. I believe this case was even reviewed by Dr. Toma when the complaint came in. So the allegations in this complaint relate solely to the drafting of the report. I realize they've been characterized as unprofessionalism in his dealings with her, but I think when you look at the complaint, those all relate solely to his report. She doesn't feel that she was listened to. She doesn't feel like he had included important information into the report that should have been there. All that being said, I think this board has already intervened with Dr. Denbor regarding that issue. And I think Dr. Denbor's done everything that this board has asked him to do in that regard. Certainly not to diminish the experience of KC, but again, I just think it's inadvisable to put someone on probation, have them go to a practice monitor for report writing, and then when they come back to it and they've done everything they're supposed to do for that probation, a new complaint comes up, it's a boomerang from the past, and then to punish them again for the exact same conduct. So that's what I would say on that point. The other thing I would say is that if I'm reading the board correctly, it seems like there's a possibility of extending a consent agreement, extending John Denbor's probation. One thing I would say is that it's also important to think about the fact that if that occurs, it's important to limit the number of the complaints that are included in that consent agreement to only those that are valid. I think sometimes boards, and I'm not saying this board, but boards that I have been in front of, have a tendency to think if we're going to push this towards a consent agreement, it doesn't matter how many allegations we throw in there. But it does matter, and here's how it matters. Down the road, John Denbor, if he continues in practice, will be asked to report about the results of this in order to continue on to work for insurance companies, to get positions, to get jobs. And it's much more difficult for licensees when they have to report a number of complaints or findings against them. And so I just would ask this board to be judicious about the findings that you make and not fall into the thinking of, well, he's already got a consent agreement, who cares, let's throw them all in there. And I'm not saying you would be that callous or that laissez-faire in your approach, but I just wanted to orient everybody to that kind of thinking. So thank you.
All right, thank you for those comments. Are there any questions for Dr. Denbor?
Ms. Shreve, may I make a statement?
Please.
Okay, thank you. My apologies for butting in there. I believe that I made a statement before this board regarding this matter, and so I'll keep my comments very brief. Casey was referred to me by Dr. Steven Erickson at the Banner Concussion Center when I was serving as a consultant between the 2015 and 2016. In documentation and in verbally, I was told that this was a workman's compensation claim. I proceeded accordingly via standard battery that I used for the majority of concussion protocol, and I respectfully dispute some of the allegations that were made by Casey in this case. I took notes extensively on everything that was said to me, and consulted with Dr. Erickson and other staff members multiple times in regards to this particular client. This was a particularly challenging evaluation because their Dr. Erickson had a suspicion of a secondary gain issue, and so hence the word memory test was conducted, which is a test of symptom validity. Casey failed that test, so the results of the tests were essentially considered invalid and not indicative of a standard concussion type of profile. I will, draw to the board's attention, as I believe that I've done in the past, that I think it's worth noting that this complaint did not come about until approximately 2 to 2.5 years later after the evaluations had occurred. And at least it's Dr. Erickson's belief, and quite honestly, my own, that it was, that the complaint itself was motivated by a denial of workman's compensation for this individual based upon Dr. Erickson's findings as the primary lead, but also based upon my own and other members of our team. I would say that I am not proud of the report in general. I don't think it's my best work, and I think I've substantially improved my work since then. That being said, I stand by the findings in the report as valid. Cohesive and coherent with Dr. Erickson's and this team's finding in this regard. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Denbor. All right. I do not believe, does any of the board members have any questions for Dr. Denbor? All right. Then I'd like to just set this one aside for a second and talk about the next. Well, let me just not do that. Let's just talk about this one. Do we feel as though there's enough merit to warrant a concern? Ms. Galvin, can you help me on this for a minute? I think the idea is, we look at all of them. If there's issues, then go ahead. We could package that. Maybe we could talk about what we can do at the end, but we need to discuss each one individually.
Right. So at this time, I would recommend that you deliberate on this and articulate whether there are any possible violations. If there are no possible violations, you could dismiss it. If there are possible violations, articulate those, but hold off on proposing any discipline until you adjudicate and get through the other three cases.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Appreciate the guidance. Are there any comments or thoughts from the board members?
Well, I think as you start discussion on something like this and try to summarize, there was an appropriate referral by a physician who was responding to concerns about his patient that following an injury, things were not the same, certainly not at work, which is where we often pick up on those types of issues. There was an appropriate referral made to a psychologist for a neuropsych eval, because head injuries, especially minor head injuries, especially closed head injuries, are the most complicated of the neuropsychological sequelae that we deal with in terms of finding answers and compensatory treatments. I think I agree with Dr. Denbor's findings that it wasn't his best work in terms of the way he wrote his report. I'd agree with that. I think Casey would agree with that. I think sometimes people, in whatever fashion, whether they're trained or whether they're over busy or rushing or inattentive to detail. What I always look for is, what was the outcome? Was the recommendations that were made helpful in furthering the function of the patient? Which is why I asked the patient whether or not the treatments that she engaged in following his evaluation was helpful. And sometimes the early treatment is not as helpful as later treatments. Sometimes it's just as helpful as later treatments. It certainly was not indicated or hinted or in any way questioned that the treatment recommendations through cognitive activities or speech therapy, sometimes some of the best treatment I've seen in minor head injuries are the cognitive speech therapy approaches, that was inappropriate or inadequate or not helpful. In fact, it was helpful. So the evaluation, while perhaps not well written, while missing in details, perhaps an attitudinal or personality issue was there, the question is, did the patient benefit from the outcome of that evaluation in moving forward?
Thank you, Dr. Bohansky. Are there any other comments? I would just note that this complaint was filed in August of 2018, right at the time when the board was considering or reviewing the complaints that had come in prior. His Dr. Denbar's consent agreement with the monitor of Dr. Toma was started in October of 2018. And that consent agreement and Dr. Toma's purpose was to pretty much focus on things just like this, and that was the writing of the reports, I guess evaluations, working with clients or whatnot. So this issue in some ways had occurred right about that time, I guess just missed that window of when we were looking at them, but it would have been part of what I see as Dr. Toma would have been focusing on as a monitor. Any other comments? Any thoughts? Motions?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yes. One of my concerns, I do feel that the report was below necessary standards. Indeed, Dr. Denbar had the practice monitor and so forth, but I'm wondering if we fail, if we were to dismiss this, it would be saying that nothing was done wrong here, and I don't feel that would be appropriate. I don't feel that the evaluation was written appropriately, and there wasn't adequate history taken. And so I think that there was a violation of standards here. It's a matter of procedurally how to go from here.
Point well taken. Any other comments? So is there a consensus as we move through this that there is a lack of professionalism with the reporting, with the report and whatnot, and just kind of put it in that parking lot right now and move on to the next? Or do we think we want to, enough where we're citing a violation regard, and remembering that this was filed right a couple months, 3 or 4 months before his practice monitor started?
I think we should put it kind of in the parking lot, as you stated, and go on to the next one, because maybe, you know, so.
All right. Is everybody okay with that? If so, we're going to move on to the next one, which is complaint 1826. With complaint number 1826, Dr. Denbor, you've already been sworn in.
Mr. Eves had his hand up.
Mr. Eves.
I'm not going to get into the deliberation just procedurally. I would ask for findings on each of these as we discuss them. I think it's problematic when we have four matters that we're considering, and I think that the board, understandably, with the overwhelming amount of paperwork here, sort of has a tendency to blend the complaints together. I think so. It's your authority, Madam Chair. I don't dispute that, but I would ask for a finding on this on liability. I'm sorry, not liability, but on unprofessional conduct.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Galvin, any comments on that?
I think as a matter of process and in an effort to keep the complaints you know, separate and apart, I would agree that it would be appropriate at this time, if you believe unprofessional conduct has occurred, to articulate what that unprofessional conduct is.
And okay. Madam Chair, if I may ask a quick question of Ms. Galvin.
Yes, Mr. Dinar.
Thank you. From a procedural perspective, if today, for example, if the meeting is going beyond, let's say, 5, 6, 7 p.m., is there anything procedurally we could do to reconvene if we are not able to get through all of the items on the agenda?
Yes, Mr. Dinar, if the board believes for whatever reason if the hour is late and if there's fatigue or we're going to lose a quorum, any matters that are not concluded on the agenda can be tabled and continued to a future meeting.
Okay, so I think, I mean, in those terms as well, if we take each complaint separately, that might help us to table some items for a future date if we need to.
All right, thank you. So going back on the, to this, what are the, Dr. Flowers, you mentioned that anyway, the finding of fact, looking.
Okay, I think a finding of fact would be the record, the report with an accurate, has multiple errors in it, did not accurately report what the patient said in regards to symptoms and about her living situation, you know, biographical information that was reported.
Thank you. Is there anything else? Do any of the other board members have any comments to add? And do we need to, Ms. Galvin, at this point, identify potential violations, or is it just the finding of facts? I just need a procedural guidance here.
No, if you believe that those findings constitute a violation, then you would set forth the violations that you have found.
Okay, right. Basically, we've discussed them before, but
do you want to take a vote to ensure that the findings are agreeable to the board members? If Dr. Flowers moves that generally the findings in this case of 1825 constitute that the report was drafted with a number of errors, including there was not an adequate reporting of her symptoms, and it was an inaccurate description of her living situation. The record, there was some testimony about the number of hours that she was working was inaccurate.
Yes, and also she apparently gave no symptoms that Dr. Denbar said that she had.
Do you want to, yes, Dr. Flowers, do you want to move those as the possible findings of fact?
Yes.
So is that a motion?
Yes, if, okay, I make a motion that what I mentioned be findings of fact.
Is there a second? I'll second it. I mean, there are findings. I think the outcome, I'm not sure what happened, but, you know, I think that I acknowledge there were problems with it. So I second it. Is there any comment? All in favor? Aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? All right, hearing none, the motion carries. And then we need to, Ms. Galvin, identify the actual statutory potential violations.
Yes, if you believe that those facts constitute a violation, then you would articulate what statutes are involved. And those are set forth in ARS 3220-61-16.
Yes, I think previously we discussed E, gross negligence in the practice of a psychologist, O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe, or otherwise engaging activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice, and then DD, violating an ethical standard adopted by the board, the AP, the ethical principle of psychologist and code of conduct. 9.01 basis for assessment. Psychologists base the opinions contained in their recommendations, reports, and diagnostics for evaluative treatments, including forensic testimony on information techniques sufficient to substantiate findings. And B, psychologists provide opinions of the psychological characteristic of individuals only after they conducted an examination of the individual's adequate to support their statements or conclusion.
So what was the first letter? What, I have O and then D, D. What was the first one?
First one was E.
That one is not mentioned on the informal, on the informal interview introduction, so I don't know if that matters or not. We had O and D, D. 9.01.
Okay. I guess Ms. Galvin, can that be added, or if we didn't notice them, should we not add that?
That's correct.
Okay, then I'll delete that. I'll delete E.
Okay. All right. So
put it O and then DD.
Okay. Any thoughts or comments? All in favor?
Was there a second?
Was there? Oh, I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. All right. So now we're going to move on to 1826. Dr. Denbar, you're still. Yes.
I'm sorry. I was just wondering if I could propose that we reconvene the meeting for the remaining agenda items. Just a thought, because I think, I think it benefits the complainants and it benefits the respondents if we, you know, are all looking at it with 100% attention, and it, at least I don't know about everyone else, but it seems like for me it's waning. So just a proposal that I wanted to put forth for all of the board members to consider.
Board members, how do you feel? Ms. Bennett?
What other items do we have, Ms. Shree, on the agenda?
We have three more informal cases, and then we have an update on the stat on the state legislative, where the state legislature is, which would be quick, and then we do have an item that Dr. Davis Wilson asked regarding behavioral analysts. Oh, we do need to make sure we talk about broadening item number 21, which has to do with the modifications of the degrees completed by students. We have a few more items. So I guess the question, Executive Director, is when will we reconvene? Is that when would we be rescheduled?
Madam Chair, that's up to the board. The next meeting, I think, is June 4th, but calling a special meeting is always an option. Scheduling with the various parties is a factor to be considered in the process.
My recommendation
is maybe... Wait one second. Let me have...
And then move it to the June 4th meeting.
I'm sorry, Ms. Dr. Malotta, I couldn't hear you. Could you say that again?
My recommendation is that we complete the other items that are still on the agenda, because I don't think they'll take too long, and move the last three cases to the next June meeting. Special meetings get extremely challenging. Most board members also have other jobs too. So I cannot give another full day, so till June, so.
Right, Mr. Eves, you had a comment? I don't know.
Thank you, Ms. Shree. I was just gonna say that I will be out of state for the June 3rd meeting, and I would not be able to attend that. So that would extend things even further. My experience with this board is that you do have some endurance and some stamina, and I have the pleasure of having been invited one Friday afternoon back for a Saturday morning meeting. And so I might suggest that maybe we do that if necessary.
It's not agendized.
Is it agendized, Heidi?
Nope.
It was not the last time either, I can believe.
No, for our in-person meetings, we always have both days, Friday and, Saturday.
Executive Director, is it agenda, are we agendized for tomorrow? No,
you are not.
Okay, so that's not an option. So let me throw this out here. Let me just see some nods or no's, or let's just go ahead and we'll move these three. If we move these three items that are on the informal interview, it appears as though it won't be the June meeting. Mr. Eves has told us he's not available. He's given us plenty of notice. We'd have to respect that. And so it would be pushed out even further, which would be July, I guess?
July 9th.
All right, if you guys are fine with that. What did you say, Dr. Malotta?
No, I mean, we generally hear these at the in-person meeting. I'm also kind of concerned that our other month meetings are turning into long day meetings. You know, we used to have this rhythm going, so it would be the August would be the next in-person meeting.
Is that in July, Ms. Heidi?
Madam Chair, the July 9th meeting is telephonic. So as Dr. Malotta indicated, the next in-person board meeting, that would be on August 14th.
Okay, so why don't you let me work on when we put this, it either be July or August. Let me work with our executive director on the agenda. So we're not gonna finish the informal interviews today. Let's go back to the rest of the agenda items, which are quick. We need, there are a couple we have to get approved.
I just want to point out that some of us have had to take off work 3 and 4 times now and haven't been able to speak.
May I ask who's speaking?
Yeah, this is LM.
Madam Chair, that's the complainant for 19-02.
I've taken off work three times all day and have not been able to speak. I can't continue to take off work.
Yes, Madam Chair, can we go ahead with one more then? Because I think that's the next one.
Who else is online who wanted to speak? We need to find out.
And this is our that's go ahead.
Who are there any, Jennifer, are there any other complainants on the line?
To my knowledge, the complainant for 1902 is the only one on the line that requested to speak. However, I do not know if perhaps another complainant called in and did not notify me that they wanted to speak. So it might be a good idea to check if any of the other complainants are on the line.
All right. Please let me know if you're a complainant that is here for the informal interview for Dr. Dunbar. Are you on the line other than the LM who that we just identified? Okay, hearing not, I would like to respect LM's being here. If we, I would like to go ahead and then and work on 1902. I do think, I think we need to be respectful of her time also. So if we can finish 1902, the other two will be placed on a future agenda, and then we will go through the other two remaining items. Dr. Dunbar, you've already been sworn in, so we're halfway through already with all the reading material I usually have to do. LM, would you like to provide us with a summary? Oh, excuse me, I got to step back. Dr. Flowers, can you provide a summary of the case?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. LM complained that the neuropsychological evaluation that was completed by Dr. Dunbar, his office in March of 2019, did not meet the standard of care. She said that Dr. Dunbar never met with her in person, did none of the testing, did not conduct an adequate history of the background, and did not obtain an adequate history or properly address the issues for which she was seeking an evaluation. She said that the report stated that she was presenting with problems thinking and memory that impact her daily life. She said this was inaccurate. LM questioned where the information was coming from because she never mentioned thinking and memory issues. She said that the neuropsych technician, KF, asked LM what her highest level of education was and what she did for work, and that this was all of the history that was taken. She complained that the report was inaccurate and confusing. She complained that billing for the services was not properly. She said the testing was completed in an hour and a half, and the telephone call in which Dr. Dunbar provided feedback regarding the results of the evaluation was approximately 9 minutes. The total amount billed was $1,050. She said that the diagnosis given was not justified by the data in the report and was not explained. LM said that it appeared that Dr. Dunbar's practice violated copyright laws. She said that on several tests it was administered, it appeared that the pages were copies of copies, particularly on the WAIS 4. She alleges that Dr. Dunbar makes false or deceptive statements in a video on his website, saying that he went to medical school in Boston and guaranteeing that people would shave off at least 5 strokes on their total score consistently. In response, Dr. Dunbar said that on March 3rd, 2019, LM presented 4 a neuropsychological evaluation based on a referral from her primary care physician. Dr. Walters requested the evaluation to assess LM's cognitive functioning, to provide differential diagnosis, and to suggest treatment based on the interpretation of test results. JS, the neuropsych technician working for Dr. Dunbar, completed the computerized assessment that included a battery of tests. Dr.
Excuse me, let me drink a bit of water before my voice gets down. After completing the assessment, that will express your dissatisfaction and concern that Dr. Denbar was not available. KS told Dr. Denbar, told her that Dr. Denbar was ill, but he would interpret the data from the results and be the one who would make the diagnosis or treatment suggestion. When Ellen requested that Dr. Denbar provide her with the results of the evaluation the same day, he would, my apologies, I don't want this to be part of the drama, but anyway, he agreed to come in and do the interpretation. He provided her with feedback that evening, and Ellen was displeased. She complained that the diagnostic information and opinion from her therapist had not been looked at. But Dr. Denbar said the therapist did not have the credentials to impeach the findings of a neuropsychologist. And he suggested she continue sessions with her therapist and encouraged her to seek a second opinion if she disagreed with his analysis. Dr. Denbar said that he told LM she would seek consultation with Dr. Christopher Nichols, who specializes in the disorder that LM said that she had. He said that he was looking for a cough drop here, which I apparently don't have, but anyway, he said that it was appropriately given, and that, anyway, he said that the informed consent and limitations of confidentiality were not explained to her at intake, but Ellen was presented with and signed two informed consent statements. The limits of confidentiality were verbally explained and included in the informed consent package that LM signed. He said that the results were appropriately explained, and he asked that the complaint be dismissed. When the board reviewed the complaint in January, it was referred to an informal interview due to ARS 32-2061-16A, obtaining a fee by fraud or misinterpretation, and ARS 32-2061-16O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. And this concludes my summary of the complaint.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers. Ellen, do you have some comments you'd like to make to the board, and then the board may have questions for you?
I do. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me here, and I look forward to providing you with further information regarding my experience with Dr. Denbar and why I came forward with this complaint. At the time of my complaint, I was enrolled in the counseling Masters of Counseling program in ASU. I was in an ethics class taught by a psychologist with over 40 years of experience teaching ethics and other psychology courses. My professor instilled in us the tools necessary to practice competently in our area of study while also being an informed healthcare consumer ourselves. For one assignment, for example, we were tasked with reviewing and writing a report on complaints filed with the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Board. After my experience with Don, I consulted with this professor, and we both agreed that my experiences rose to the degree of a formal complaint with this board. No way was I attempting to exercise any expertise or criticize John's practice as a colleague. It is my role as a consumer to bring my experience to the board so that they can make that a determination, not me. I would also like to say that I've never submitted a complaint to any board, take no pleasure in doing this, and would much rather be spending time in session with my patients or at home with my family.
I ended up in John's office because I was struggling personally and in school with poor time management, lack of focus, inability to sustain any sort of routine, and procrastination. Despite my struggles, I did well in school because of other strengths I had, and no one was the wiser until it was time to complete my master's research thesis, which took an incredible amount of time and planning and forethought, all the skills I did not possess, which, by the way, thank God that is over. After one session with the psychologist that I had been seeing for the reasons I felt like I had an answer, and there is some hope knowing that I wasn't organically lazy. As much hope as I had, much of the discussion I had with the psychologist was how terrified I was of stimulants and their addictive nature. She responded with teaching me about non-stimulant options, which quelled many of my fears. I talked to my PCP about this, and he referred me to John to rule out any other possibilities, such as learning disabilities, etc. I had a poor experience with John. I was rescheduled once because he was at another location, was told that bringing a person who knew me well, my fiance, would not be helpful. I had bet this was commonplace in testing, and that bringing in other records would not be helpful. I had testing records from when I was in high school, many of which were neuropsychological tests. I won't belabor John's point that I was threatening. That is simply not true. I was not angry, threatening, or adversarial, nor was I angry at John, as he had mentioned in a previous meeting. I had never met him. I was simply concerned about my experience and expressed that very professionally. During my appointment, I was asked two personal questions, my level of education and occupation, by the technician. No further history was taken about me. Given this, unless I'm mistaken, it appears that 90791, which is the intake interview, medical services, integrated biopsychosocial assessment, whatever you want to call it, billing code was billed fraudulently. Even more surprisingly, after a closer review of my billing, 96132 was billed, and then an additional four units, not one, but four units of 96133 was billed. This indicated that John, at the very least, completed 4 hours of work, taking into account one, this simply cannot be true. This is fraudulent. Anyway, I simply wanted an answer as to why I might be struggling so much. For example, if I did pass the test, how could other factors affect my lack of performance in everyday life? For example, what about what I experienced as a child? I expected an expert to hear my concerns, recognize, and respond to them professionally. Unfortunately, I received a very terse phone call in which he did not answer my questions directly. He seemed distracted and not very present over the phone. For example, I asked very clearly if he can explain how one psychologist could say one thing and how another could say something different. My therapist was not a therapist. She was a psychologist, PhD psychologist in counseling psychology. A simple explanation on the difference between neuropsychology and psychology would suffice. A simple explanation as to the validity of the testing or how I might move forward with the symptoms I'm experiencing would help. Instead, he was defensive, and the feedback I got was that I could call someone else, and he gave me their name, that someone else that he recommended does not take insurance. I attempted to call John back after feeling distraught after that phone call, but he did not answer nor call me back. So after John shut that door and feeling confident about what was going on, I decided to get a second opinion, and that I did. I paid Dr. Nichols, an expert in the problem, by experience, a visit. I paid a lot of money for an expert to sit down and explain to me what was going on with me and answer the questions I had, because John did not offer any further explanation. Had I not had the resources or stamina, I would have not engaged in any more treatment. When I met with Dr. Nichols, he reviewed my files and conducted a thorough clinical interview. He stated that for what issues I was describing, he would have conducted different tests, as the test I was given was a very generic battery of tests. After a thorough interview about what I had been experiencing and reviewing my records, Dr. Nichols did diagnose me with what I had suspected, as well as many others. And
Don't give the diagnosis. I just remind you.
I won't. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
Uh-huh. Anne was provided medication for my PCP, which, by the way, is a low-dose, non-stimulant medication. Non-stimulant. That I have now been on for over a year. I can honestly say that I no longer struggle with poor time management, lack of focus, inability to sustain any sort of routine or procrastination, as evidenced by actually writing out what I'm talking about today instead of the first time I came to this board. I owe this all to Dr. Nichols. He talked to me about certain behavioral things that I might help, recommended a couple of books for me to read. There are other problems as well. Last time we met, I mentioned my concerns about copyright for many of the tests. As I was taking the test, it was clear that I was using photocopied copywritten material. For example, I specifically remember this when taking subtests on the waist because I was frustrated because since it was photocopied, certain shapes were not dark anymore due to it being lighter and lighter due to the photocopies. So it was difficult to make accurate selection. I met with one of the technicians that worked with John because I went and requested to see if I could get those tests so that I could show the board myself. However, because of whatever laws there are, I'm not allowed to, like I'm not a psychologist. Tenson reviewed my records, and it was mutually agreed upon that she could speak to this board about the technical issues concerning billing and the scoring issues, which was new to me. I would appreciate it, and I would request that she be able to speak on behalf of me in regards to those complaints or those issues. I really appreciate you all being here to hear my concerns and taking these matters seriously. I've gone from being a graduate student at the time of the complaint to now being a licensed associate counselor with the Board of Behavioral Health in the time that it's taken this complaint to get this far. I've taken time off of work and time that I could have spent with family to ensure that I do my due diligence, and I'd really trust that these matters can be resolved swiftly. Please let me know if you have any further questions. Thank you.
Ms. Shereen, if I could, we should ask LM to affirm the accuracy of the statement that she just made, please, for the record.
You were sworn in, LM.
Yeah, LM, you told the whole truth and nothing but the truth, correct?
This is correct.
Thank you. All right, I guess. Thank you. Sorry, I was supposed to probably do it beforehand, but it still counts if I say it afterwards and you test it. All right. Well, thank you for your comments. And does the board have any questions for LM?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have a couple.
Dr. Flowers.
Yes. Thank you again for showing up again. It sounds like an exercise of persistence.
It is.
But anyway, I asked your questions previously, just wanted to kind of touch on them again. During the interviews you had with the technician where you asked to provide a history of symptoms and problems associated with the condition for which you referred.
I was not, and what's more surprising, I wasn't. Like, the list of symptoms from the DSM-5 were not ever asked of me. No symptoms were ever asked of me. This was performed by the technician. The technician extrapolated off of what I said. For example, I was nervous, right? So I'm talking to this person who is not credentialed, and she asked what I did for school, and I think I briefly mentioned that I don't even know that I was in my master's program, and she extrapolated that I must be doing well, and that was surprising to me, but no direct questions were asked of me.
Okay, and I'm wondering, I think you said this, but I want to just have it repeated again. Did Dr. Denbauer meet with you in person for any part of the neuropsychological assessment?
He never met me in person.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, this is Dr. Gill.
Dr. Gill.
I just wanted to
I just wanted to quickly ask LM, thank you for being with us today. There was a mention of either a limited or a non-existent informed consent. Can you, do you recall or did you participate in hearing informed consent regarding the treatment?
John, well, of course, John never asked me because I didn't meet him, but the technician definitely did not provide any type of informed consent. I guess I obviously signed something. What's that?
You said you signed something?
I think so. So I think I got records. So I think I did sign something, unless I'm mistaken. There's a lot of paperwork, but nothing was ever provided orally.
And what about confidentiality?
That was never explained to me.
That was never explained, not verbally and not in writing?
Never. I can't speak to the writing. I really can't say. But orally, never the case.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Gill, I think the informed consent's on page 71. Are there any other questions for LM? Mr. Eves and Dr. Denborg, do you have any questions you'd like to address to me, to LM?
I do. This is Artie Eves. I'd like to address a few questions to LM, please.
Mr. Eves, they're addressed to me, and then if I feel they're appropriate, then I ask LM.
With your permission, I'll state them as if they're stated to LM, and then I understand that you perform a gatekeeper function to see if those should be passed on to her. Is that
perfect.
Okay?
All right. Okay, thank you.
All right. You have said here today that you did not sign an informed consent. Are you as sure of that fact as you are of the other facts you have reported here today?
Well, I feel comfortable answer that. Yeah, I don't think I have ever said that I didn't sign anything. I said I couldn't speak to it. And in fact, I just went through my records and I did find it. So yes, I did sign something. I never said that I didn't sign anything. And I will say that I never was told that orally. And yes, I am sure of everything that I just said.
You have acknowledged that Dr. Denborg was not present. Do you acknowledge that you were told that Dr. Denborg was very ill that day before you showed up for your appointment?
I was not told that before I showed up for my appointment.
All right. Were you told that when you showed up for your appointment?
I was told that when I asked when I would see the doctor. I was not told that upon signing in for my appointment.
Ms. Shreve, I'm addressing these to you. I don't want to lose sight of your gatekeeping function. When do you contend that you were told in the process that Dr. Denborg was very ill and would not be able to see you that day?
Go ahead, LM. I was told as I was signing in, and I asked if I would be seeing the doctor initially because I had the impression given how the office was operating. I didn't see him. I saw whatever. I just had the sense, given my poor experience over the phone, that I would not be seeing the doctor, and that in fact was true. So I asked the secretary if I would be seeing the doctor at the beginning because I was anxious and because it appeared to me that perhaps I would not be.
Upon being told that you would not see the doctor that day because he was quite ill, did you agree to continue with the appointment without his presence?
Go ahead, LM, and answer. Well, they didn't ask me if I was okay with it. It was just matter of fact, okay. Then I proceeded with the appointment and was professionally and personally concerned.
Did you express any of your professional or personal concerns to anyone in the office?
I expressed my concern with the technician because I assumed she had some training that was kind of off, that was off to me. And I was curious as to what the ethics regarding psychology were, because in my experience, or I'm sorry, in my training in counseling, that is not okay. And so I inquired about the ethics about that, and I pretty much said, like, that's interesting. I didn't realize that was acceptable.
You were told at the time of intake that Dr. Denbor was ill and would not be able to see you that day. You've now expressed that you had concerns about proceeding that day with a technician. Did you ever ask to reschedule your appointment for another day when Dr. Denbor was present?
I had already been rescheduled once. It takes time to make these appointments. I was quite frankly suffering and I needed help. And I needed answers. And I needed somebody to talk to me about what was happening. And I suspected that at the very least I would be provided with adequate services. Therefore, I did not request, which in my opinion is not my responsibility, but I did not request that I be rescheduled for a second time.
All right. So I take it from that answer that the answer is no, you did not ask to be seen on a different day when you learned that Dr. Denbor would be unable to see you that day.
I guess that you could make that presumption.
Right. At the time you had this appointment, you were in a graduate program for counseling, is that correct?
This is correct.
How far along were you in that program?
I was in, let's see, I graduated in May of 2017. Right, no, that's when I graduated college. I graduated in May of 2019, and so this was conducted in March of 2019, correct? So I would say pretty far along.
Where did you attend undergraduate college?
I graduated from an accredited school at Christopher Newport University in Newport News, Virginia.
What was your grade point average, your cumulative grade point average upon graduating?
Ms. Chairman, I don't think that that's relevant.
I don't think so.
Mr. Chairman, I would argue that it is relevant because this is a finding that is specific to her allegations. And so what I would say is that she is disputing his findings. One of his findings was based on her academic performance historically. I think it is
okay.
Fair, and I think it's important for this board to
know. I'll answer that question. I'll actually add a few additional details. I can't remember my exact GPA, but I graduated between a 3.3 and a 3.50 unweighted GPA. I completed many upper level classes in testing, actually completed very advanced multi-level various statistics in my undergraduate. I completed a bachelor's of science electively instead of a bachelor's of arts in psychology. I took a testing course in a 400 level course. So I have a very limited background in testing, and it gave me a bit of insight to know that something was wrong.
Would you agree that you performed quite well in your academic studies in undergraduate?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? I didn't hear you.
Would you agree that you performed quite well during your undergraduate studies?
I performed adequately, and I think other strengths of mine really had to be noted for me to perform as well as I did perform. I started out as a biology major and performed quite poorly, and so I took a different path, which ended up being quite good for me, but I frankly never studied, and that's a problem.
Would you agree that the reason that you were referred to Dr. Denbor was to see if a stimulant prescription was justified for you?
No. I mean, whether it was justified or not is one thing, but I in no way wanted a stimulant medication. It's scary to me. And in fact, I never wanted a stimulant, and I did not receive a stimulant.
Would you agree that you wanted medication that was intended for the treatment of the issues you have referred to? We're not going to talk about the diagnosis, but dealing with focus performance.
You know, I more so wanted an explanation. For example, I talked with the psychologist, therapist that I had been talking with, and was very frank about if this is not the diagnosis that, you know, we were suspecting, that's fine. If it is, in fact, a mild mood disorder that is impairing my concentration, so be it. But I've been trying to treat said mood disorder for quite a while, and nothing seems to be working. So further explanation was warranted. And so, no, I was not seeking any specific diagnosis. I was seeking an explanation as to why I was experiencing the symptoms I was experiencing for such a prolonged amount of time. I hope that answers your question.
LM, you said earlier that you had consulted with one of your professors regarding billing issues and codes in this case. Did I hear that correctly?
I consulted with many professors. I'm not sure about the billing issues per se that might have been brought up. I did not, until further review of my records, I didn't see how severe the billing issues were. I was mostly concerned at that time with the felt experience of, with the experience just in globally. So I did consult with a professor who has, I mean, she retired, and I really hope she's enjoying retirement because she spent a lot of years specifically teaching ethics, and I'm quite proud to be one of her mentees. But yes, I consulted with her and one other professor, maybe a third.
That expert doesn't have any report that's before this board. I presume that you acknowledge that you are not an expert when it comes to the practice of psychology or psychological ethics.
I am not an expert. By any means, I consulted an expert, and although I did my due diligence, I'm not going to have somebody. I have many other things to do in my life than worry about this instance.
Well, I assume also that you'll acknowledge that you are not an expert in the area of psychological billing.
Ms. Shreve?
Wait, this protocol here, Ms. Galvin, I need your... Okay, Ms. Dr. Watt?
Yeah, I feel like we are, but the LM is being put on trial, and her part is to share her story, a few questions. I'm really feeling very uncomfortable with this line of questioning that's going on.
Ms. Galvin, could you?
I would second that.
You have the authority, Ms. Shreve, to end the questioning.
May I be heard, Ms. Shreve?
I'm sorry?
May I be heard on the point?
Yes, briefly.
I apologize if anyone on the board has considered this putting her on trial, but we do have the opportunity to question her. I've tried to limit my questions to the evidentiary issues before you, specifically that she's not an expert on many of the things that she's contended to be today. She's told you she's talked to experts about this and that and the other thing. We don't have any reports from those experts. She's acknowledging she's not an expert on those issues. Those are important evidentiary issues when it comes to findings in a case like this. So I'm sorry if it felt like I was aggressively going after her. That's not my intention whatsoever. I'm not trying to do that. I think I've been professional and dignified in my questioning. I've just simply tried to get to the point of illustrating she doesn't have the expertise to opine on many of the things that she's opined on in front of this board here today?
I haven't opined. I've simply explained my experience.
All right. Mr. Reeves, do you have anything else that you'd like to ask?
I believe that Ellen admitted she was not an expert in billing. With that, I'll conclude my questioning. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Reeves. All right. Any other questions for LM? All right, LM, thank you for participating today. The board now is going to move on with this case with Dr. Is there any questions for Dr. Dunbar and or Mr. Eves, do you have any comments?
Ms. Shreve, do I have the opportunity to
Dr. Dunbar, wait a minute. Mr. Eves, you're representing your client. Are you speaking or is your client speaking?
I was speaking, but I think John wants to make a statement, and I'm happy to yield to him.
Okay. Dr. Dunbar.
Hi. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to address this once again. Just briefly, this case was reviewed by Dr. Toma specifically. He found that my documentation, the tests that I had conducted, and the billing that I had conducted to be standard in this area and not deficient in any way. I conduct a very standard battery for this sort of diagnosis. The client passed all tests. That's not to take anything away from Dr. Nichols, who's an excellent neuropsychologist, and he may have arrived at a different diagnosis. I was very sick and at home throwing up, and I received a text message and a call from my neuropsychometrist saying that there was a patient that was yelling in our office, and that I better get into the office as soon as possible. I then attempted to get into the office at around 3:30. My understanding is that LM had taken the test, that they were she was gone at the time, and then I was told by my secretary as well as the people that were in the office that she was hostile and belligerent with the testing tech and the staff, and that I should call her right away to give her the results. So I immediately, as Ellen may or may not be aware, but this board is aware, techs are not responsible for conducting in-depth interviews, nor would they ever do so. They wouldn't also score tests, or I would say they wouldn't score tests comprehensively. They wouldn't interpret tests. They certainly wouldn't write reports or give feedback. So I came into the office to do that. I did that, and I agree with LM that the phone call did last 9 minutes, and because after getting yelled at by her multiple times, I said, if you disagree with my findings, then you can seek evaluation from Dr. Nichols, which she did, and I'm very glad that she had a far better experience with Dr. Nichols than she had with me. But the billing is, again, the billing was conducted in a very accurate way. This was, again, reviewed by Dr. Toma as well as the report itself. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Are there questions from the board? Dr. Malott?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Okay,
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes, I think, we did talk about some of these issues in our previous meeting, but one of the issues was that you were not physically present to do an interview with the client, and apparently there was no clinical interview with her to ask about her primary complaint, and as I recall, you said that that was appropriate, and I suggested that you review that practice with your practice monitor to see if he agreed with you. Did you specifically tell him that I wasn't there that day, and this is what transpired, and was he on board with that?
I might respectfully disagree with your assertion, Dr. Flowers, in a couple of different areas, but long story short, I did speak with Dr. Tom. I did tell him exactly as a complaint would come in, if a complaint would come in, I ran that complaint by him very comprehensively. So I did tell him exactly what had happened in regards to this. And might I add, I don't believe that I ever asserted, nor do I agree with the fact that a clinical interview should not be conducted. I talked to the client's PCP twice in regards to this matter. I talked to the client in regards to the symptoms that she was experiencing. During our phone call, I did not conduct the kind of clinical interview, in-depth clinical interview that I would have wanted, but it fell short due to what I would describe as a pretty adversarial nature once she got the test results.
Okay, but I guess what I'm saying is, did Dr. Tolma have any concerns because you were not present to do any kind of face-to-face interview with her for the evaluation?
I would just respectfully say that, to me, he did not express any concerns, but I think we both would agree that being present during a neuropsych evaluation is certainly the preferential way to do it, but there is a billing code that allows you to be available but not physically present, and that billing code was used in the situation.
All right, thank you.
Are there any further questions for Dr. Denbor? Yes, Dr. Meyer.
Yes, Dr. Denbor, thank you. So, did you ever meet with her in person?
No, sir.
Okay, and how long was the phone call that you had with her?
I didn't time it myself. She reports 9 minutes. I think I would be guessing, but that could be about that time. It was a very brief phone call, ultimately.
And you billed for an intake evaluation for that 9 minutes? Is that?
We billed for an intake evaluation and incorporated that time, as well as the time spent with the tech, as well as the time spent in professional discourse with her PCP.
Okay. And at this point, I know you had already been working with Dr. Tolma. Have you already made the changes to your billing practices and how you ran your business operations at this point?
At the point of the complaint?
Yeah, at the point of this assessment in March 15th or 8th or something like that.
Well, I wouldn't say that I had made all the changes. I would say that the changes that I made to my entire practice at Dr. Toma's advice were made throughout the entire practice monitoring period.
Okay, so when he said in his report that when he first started working with you, you had already made substantial changes to your billing practice, had that already occurred at this point?
Had that already occurred? Maybe I'm just not understanding the question. I guess I would just say in this regard, neither Dr. Tolma nor myself felt that there were any billing problems in this report. I think I had made significant changes prior, and I continued to make changes, but this was reviewed very specifically by Dr. Tolma in terms of the codes and the time used, and he felt that there was no errors in regards to it.
Dr. Meyer, okay. This is Artie Eves. I was aware of what was going on during this time frame, and I can tell you that my recollection is the billing changes that they talked about early on in the process related to some personnel changes that did, in fact, have a big impact on his billing practice. But it's also my recollection that the next step in the practice monitoring process was a periodic review of the reports that John was producing, and that went on for some time. And then towards the end of the practice monitoring process, Dr. Toma agreed to do an audit of John's practice, which is the time at which he sort of did this top-to-bottom review, to the best of his ability, of a lot of John's practices, including billing, informed consent, those sorts of things. So that was taking place towards the end.
Mr. Eaves, just a minute. Mr. Eaves, Dr. Bohansky cannot get back in the meeting.
I'm back in now.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Glad you're back. All right. Any other questions for Dr. Dengler?
I have one additional. Why, when you were, my understanding is that one appointment had already been rescheduled for LM, and then on the second time she came in, she was not notified that you were out sick prior to her arriving. Is that correct?
I believe that that's accurate, although I quite honestly don't entirely remember. It's probably, you know, just so the board is aware, I was not informed that she was rescheduled once prior. And without looking at the records, I don't know if that was rescheduled by our staff or rescheduled by her. I'm assuming it's rescheduled by our staff. And okay. I quite frankly am not sure why she was not informed that I was sick and out prior to her showing up. She certainly should have been.
Okay. Why was she seen if you were not there? There were implications that she should have decided that wasn't appropriate if she was not concerned, but why did this evaluation continue or be conducted when you weren't there?
Well, I think you could best ask our neuropsych tech, I don't know if I can use her name, but TP. She had indicated to me that the patient had demanded to be seen, and when was told that I was not present, then there was, they basically had asked her if she wanted to go forward with the testing, and she indicated that she did. It is acceptable practice in neuropsychology to conduct assessments when the individual, the neuropsychologist, is not present, physically present. There's actually a code for that, 96119. So it's not a preferred method of practice, but neuropsychologists do it, and they do it somewhat frequently. But that was essentially why.
What's the code for when you're not there?
There's 96118 is when you're there. 96119 is when you're not there. And there's various codes that you can use when the neuropsychologist is not present. Medicare insurance companies do not require a neuropsychologist to be physically present to conduct an evaluation. In fact, they're conducted via neuropsychology text, and I believe that position statement by the National Academy of Neuropsychology, Division 40, was submitted to this board.
Okay, so how do you determine what battery of tests to give when you haven't talked to her yet?
Well, I talked to her PCP twice prior to the evaluation. And I understand that the referral question that I had was for the diagnosis in question. So my understanding was from the PCP that she was struggling with these various issues, that, as you mentioned, that she had a possible diagnosis of this diagnosis, and that she was looking for stimulant medication, according to her PCP. So I constructed a battery on the basis of that provisional diagnosis.
Okay, thank you.
All right, are there any further questions? All right, hearing none, thank you both parties for answering questions. The committee is now just gonna deliberate. I forget, Dr. Flowers, are you the lead on this one? Or do you have any comments you'd like to start with?
My review of the documentation of this complaint led to a number of concerns. One of the key ones, of course, was never meeting with the client face-to-face, even though the written report implies that he met with the client to conduct a clinical interview and testing, even though he did not. The report's poorly written and has some obvious errors, and there's inadequate documentation of the chief complaint of the client in history. It basically was essentially not done. And the rationale for the diagnosis that was provided did not apply or adequate. And also I'm concerned that he relied excessively on the testing interview conducted by a non-licensed mental psych tech. And I also am concerned about billing practices and concerns about how he or employees might be violating copyright laws on test materials. I invite other members for their opinions and input.
Other members?
Yes, this is Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Denbauer was already being monitored through the consent agreement. And halfway through, I think. And there are the same issues still occurring at this point that were occurring beforehand. And I see this performance as incredibly unprofessional and severe concerns. I think it's a separate ongoing issue that does not get wrapped into existing consent agenda. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, he was halfway through, it appears to be like almost half, he was halfway through the practice monitors. Any other comments? Okay, do we have any, Dr. Bohansky?
You know, it's more out of frustration that I comment. I'll shoot myself later for doing it, but I'm not certain why this is a disliked client. And I always get concerned about victim blaming, which is an...
I can't hear you, Dr. Bohansky. Dr. Bohansky, I can't hear you. Move this... are you calling back in, Dr. Bohansky? Are you nodding? I don't think you can hear me. We'll just give him a minute. Thank you, everyone, for your patience with this process. And Dr. Malott, I think I heard you say that you do this a lot during the day with these Zoom meetings. You are a wonderful person. It's just difficult.
Yep. I can spend 8 hours a day doing a meeting after meeting. So, but they're broken up. It's not one long meeting.
Okay. It looks like Dr. Bohansky's trying. Ms. Poe, can you see if he's accessing?
I just admitted him, Madam Shreve.
All right.
Yeah, I don't know why I keep getting kicked out of the meeting. It's always when I'm about to get upset.
It's
or
not
something.
All right, Dr. Bohansky.
Yeah, the phone knows me. I agree with Dr. Myers and his observation on this, and I'm getting a little frustrated. As I was trying to say, it takes a lot for a complainant to come forward, especially a complainant learning about our field. Often they're in a student mode and more intimidated by professionals, let alone a whole board of professionals who don't know what's going on. The complainant's a fact witness, and she gave us facts. Facts like I went and talked to somebody who I was learning from, one of my professors. I was concerned about what was happening, so I tried to learn more about it. Those are facts about what somebody did. She was not opining. Opining is when you draw a conclusion from what somebody else gave you. So I'm a bit concerned that having to go through that also puts a sense of blame on the victim. This is somebody who I'm concerned was treated poorly. She is not an expert on billing, but she certainly is somebody who can express the fact that she reviewed a bill. Patients don't do often enough. Certainly people coming out of the hospital don't do often enough. She can express a fact that this bill was submitted for this many units at this time, and I'm not certain to this point that even Dr. Toma would agree that billing multiple units without spending that amount of time is an appropriate act, and I've heard this multiple times in this practice. Billing units are tied to time, and time is tied to the progress note, and the amount of time you spend with somebody is what you bill for. I've not seen it done any other way. She didn't express an opinion as to whether that was right or wrong. She expressed an opinion as to, or rather a fact statement as to what she saw on her statements. So, as noted, if this is during supervision and the supervision said this is okay, I guess I think we probably need different supervision.
All right, any other comments? All right, are there any finding of fact?
Yes, Madam Chair, I can certainly provide some. One is that the psychologist should not interview the patient. There are inaccuracies in the report. I did not see adequate justification for the diagnosis that was given. There was inadequate documentation of the patient's reporting his presenting complaint. Those are my main ones that come to mind.
All right. Dr. Meyer, did I see you? Okay.
Yeah, I think there's the concerns about fraudulent billing or obtaining a fee. What I forget the statement of that, but and then the lack of meeting with the client, making determinations without interacting with her. I mean, there's, I see this as unprofessional conduct.
All right, so we have those finding of facts. Does someone want to make a motion that would include the acceptance of the finding of facts that were just mentioned?
Madam Chair, I make that motion.
Can I add one thing real quick? Is that Eliam also testified that the testing material that she was given were photocopies, and that it affected her ability to perform accurately because of distortions and fading. So here's yet another piece of evidence that photocopies were being used for a copyrighted assessment.
All right, thank you. All right, so I added that one. All right, Dr. Flowers, were you going to make a motion? Are you going to make a motion?
I make a motion that
the findings that were mentioned?
With the findings that we just mentioned, unprofessional conduct, ARS
32-2061. Dr. Flowers, right now, we're just mentioning the finding of facts. Not the violation.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
We're just identifying. All right, so you mentioned several, and Dr. Myers has mentioned several.
Okay.
Are you making a motion that we accept those?
Yes, I make a motion that all that I mentioned and also Dr. Meyer stated be findings of fact for the board.
All right, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Seconded.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? All right, hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Diner is opposed.
Okay, Mr. Diner is opposed. We have one opposed. So the motion carries. Now is the time where we would then say, what are the potential violations? And I think the violations that were identified in the complaint notice was ARS 32-2061, obtaining a fee for fraudulent or misrepresentation, and then 32-2061-16-0, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards. Are Dr. Flowers, those are the two that were mentioned. Are those what you would you, is there a motion?
Yes, those were the two that I prematurely began making a motion on that I think is now okay. So I'll make that motion.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Dinar is opposed.
Mr. Dinar is opposed, so a motion carries. So those two have been heard today. The other two will be moved to a future meeting to yet be determined. We will notify everybody. We do know, Mr. Eves, you're not available in June, so that's been noted. I know everyone's time is, everyone is just totally weary, but I want to go over one item. Yes.
I just want to re-urge one more time. I just would like to re-urge one more time my request that we push on through. I don't think the other two complaints have complainants. There's no interview. I think we can finish them quickly. I know this board and Dr. Denbor have waited very patiently to bring these things to a head, and I hate to think of delaying these on for two or three more months before we have some sort of resolution here.
Board members? I just think
I don't think it is in the interest of anyone to proceed when the board members are not at their 100%. So if it's fine with everyone else to go forward with this, it's your individual decision, and then if we have a quorum, the board can proceed, but then I would be signing off from the meeting in a short while.
Other board members? Other board members, are you willing to stay or do you want to sign off? That's what I need to know.
Madam Chair, I'm willing to stay or end the meeting, whichever is the preference of other board members.
Dr. Myers?
I'll stay if we have to.
Dr. Malott, I need some feedback.
If we can get through it quickly, I'd rather be done.
Okay.
I mean, we've been doing this for months.
Okay, Dr. Wohansky, are you nodding yes? Are you okay to stay? I know it's been a long day. Is Dr. Davis Wilson still with us?
Yeah.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
She's on me.
Okay, Dr. Gill, are you still with us? Dr. Davies?
Yep, you've got me for about 25 more minutes.
All right, let's just see if we can do 1825. 1825 has to do with the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona. Dr. Flowers, can you just give a very brief update on this one? And there is no, I do not believe that there is a complainant here. Is that correct, Jennifer?
That is correct.
Okay, Dr. Flowers,
Really quickly, this is Dinar. I want to thank everyone for holding through, but I'm signing off right now.
Thank you for being with us today. I know it's
just been a long day, so thank you so much for your time.
I wish I could have stayed, but, yeah, it's just not possible.
Not a problem.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Flowers, if you could do a brief summary.
Which one?
You know, Ms. Shreve, it's Artie Eves again. I'm sorry. If Dinar can't be here, we can postpone them, I guess. I wasn't trying to force people to do this. I just thought everybody could be available. We have the whole day.
We still have a quorum.
We can move forward.
Okay.
So, all right, Dr. Flowers, if you could provide a brief overview.
Okay, and I've lost track of which one we're on.
This is 1826 with Blue Cross Blue Shield. This had to do with an audit.
Okay. Okay, it's very difficult for me to be brief, as you know. I will do my best. Basically, E.T. Blue Cross, basically he said that Dr. Ben Bauer presented his program at assisted living facilities and promotes the program is free or covered under insurance. E.T. complained that the bills for the SMART program under practice are given at times to people who have no history of cognitive dysfunction, and that none of the members had one-on-one sessions with Dr. Denbar, but there'd be times that they'd be billed for them anyway. There'd be, at one point, when we had the complaint screening committee meeting in July, BT says that at the time, 1 hour, 19 minutes, and 54 seconds of the recording, Dr. Denbar said that the complaint screening committee, he said that he gives few psychotherapy sessions, but in the plan's analysis, they found 1,015 times for their members between 2016 and 2019. He complained that services often provided by non-credential people, and also that there is documentation billed with psychotherapy that did not meet the standards for that. Basically, he said they determined, this is this letter of July 2019, that services not medically necessary, unqualified people giving services, billing was done incorrectly, signatures from the provider missing or not meeting standards. No medical records submitted to support the services billed, and they did terminate the contract with the provider. And then there was a new observation made where Blue Cross identified other claims audited to the program. And what he said, what was stated was that some of the denied bills were resubmitted under a different code, and that they were also being denied because they were not adequately documented or appropriate. And then we did, the board reviewed the case back in January, and there were a number of things we were concerned about, obtaining a fee by fraud or misrepresentation, making statements of character tending to deceive, both negligence and practice psychologists, not having adequate records, providing services that are not necessary, unnecessary or unsafe, and activities that are unprofessional by today's standards, and then also ethics on fees and financial arrangements. There is also additional information received from Blue Cross after the January meeting. There was additional audits that said that other records were looked at by the Medicare Advantage line of the business, and they found that they were reviewed by a board-certified psychiatrist, finding that there was 100% error rate for different issues, services not medically necessary, information and services provided by unlicensed people, psychotherapy that is not really done, documentation not supporting the diagnosis, and those kind of things. The Dr. Denbauer did respond and talked about how he did indeed go to different assisted living facilities and evaluations would be given, and individuals would be, some of them would volunteer and have signed informed consent, and that he would provide recommendations to the individuals that might include recommendations to do SMART program or other issues. He said that he's working with Blue Cross to try to rectify things. And this concludes my summary of the complaint.
Thank you. Thank you, Flowers. Ms. Reeves, do you have any comments or introduction regarding this case? Since there's no complaint.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This pertains to all of John Denbauer's complaints today. I was in the previous complaint in 1902. LM had asked that I speak on her behalf. I was just wondering if I was able to.
We have already concluded that that case, and so we do not need your testimony this time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Reeves.
We've talked about this at length at these board meetings in the past. I'll just reemphasize the history of this case is that a Blue Cross Blue Shield auditor filed a complaint with this board after John's office, and particularly one employee in his office, did not notify John about a request for backup records. So none of those records were provided to Blue Cross Blue Shield. After that was brought to the attention of John through this board, we did provide something like 96% of the records to back that up. Dr. Bohansky has pointed out in the past that 96 is not 100, and he's right. Happy to say I agree with him on that. But we did provide the vast majority of those records. I think that there is, Dr. Lichtenberg obviously did review these records. He looked at them, but there was a debate that occurred the day that he reported on it. Not a direct debate, but Dr. Lichtenberg spoke, and so did Dr. Toma, and so did Dr. Denbauer. And I think that the consensus that we came to on this case was that it's one thing for people to have differences of opinions as to how billing is done. It's another thing to accuse someone of fraud. And in this case, I think that there is some room for differences of opinion. I don't think that Dr. Lichtenberg's opinions rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence that John did something, you know, that was fraudulently or intentionally motivated. I think he has questions about the billing. But I think Dr. Lichtenberg acknowledges that this is not his area of expertise. The dementia mitigation field is not his area of expertise. He doesn't know anything about it. He also acknowledged in his presentation to this board, I think the way he said it was, he hasn't billed insurance in 20 to 30 years. He's not been on private pay ever since. So at this point, what you have is a Blue Cross Blue Shield investigation, which has been abandoned by Blue Cross Blue Shield. You have a report from Dr. Lichtenberg, who hasn't billed insurance in 20 to 30 years by his own admission. And you've got pretty good submissions from Dr. Denbauer and from our side of the aisle saying that Dr. Denbauer's practices are within the standard of care. So again, I think the evidence here fails to rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence of anything that would merit a finding of unprofessional conduct. Thank you.
Mr. Reeves, when you say that Blue Cross Blue Shield abandoned what do you mean? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that was said earlier in the meeting today, Ms. Shreve, unless I misheard that. I heard that Blue Cross Blue Shield had walked away from this investigation and this audit.
I thought that was Aetna.
I think they said Aetna, and then they came back and said Blue Cross Blue Shield had done the same thing. If
okay.
I'm wrong on that,
I apologize,
but that's what I heard.
All right. Are there any questions for Dr. Denbauer, Dr. Malott?
I didn't read it quite as abandonment. I read it that in some ways they sanctioned Dr. Denbauer and they terminated. He cannot be a provider with Blue Cross Blue Shield. So they did take action.
No, they took action.
Dr. Denbauer didn't have any control over that. So what I would say is if you remember, he was locked out of the business.
The last thing we were able to do was try to compile all of the records that we could. Dr. Denbor had no communication from GF, who spoke here earlier today, about the pendency of the Blue Cross Blue Shield investigation. So we're at a little bit of a loss here, and I don't think the board has all of the information in front of them either. So it has been terminated. That investigation, I personally haven't seen where they ended it with findings of any kind, certainly not that have been submitted to this board.
This is Dr. Denbor. May I say something?
Yes, Dr. Denbor.
Okay, I just do want to clarify. My understanding, although I don't have full knowledge of this, is that our billing company from our previous business may have been terminated, although I haven't seen the documentation to that effect. But I still retain an individual contract with Blue Cross Blue Shield Advantage Plan of Arizona.
All right, thank you. All right, are there any other questions for Dr. Denbor?
Madam Chair, there are massive records that we have that I believe document some of the concerns. I can touch on a couple of them and ask questions about them if board members would like me to do that.
Why don't you point a couple out then, please?
Okay, there's one, and it's on our page, PDF page 41, where ML's primary care provider made a referral for a neurological evaluation. It was erroneously made to Dr. Denbor, and the member went to the appointment in August the 16th of 2018. When she arrived, she told staff members she's in the wrong place because she's supposed to be a neurologist. But then she met with Dr. Denbor for 10 minutes, told him that she was in the wrong place. He told her that she should have the testing anyway because the insurance would pay for it. And then the client claimed that he tried to scare her by saying she could die if there's a problem with her brain. The member left with no test being done. ML sent a message to her provider regarding the referral error, and the provider said that she was supposed to see a neurologist. And then she was shocked when she received a bill from Dr. Denbor's office because she received no services, and the bill was for $597.38. The report is on PDF 66. Basically, it says that LM declined the assessment and said she's in both the neurologist. It appears that Dr. Denbor did not complete a mental status exam, clinical interview, or testing, but he did ask a few questions and then generated a bill on PDF 68, a psychiatric diagnostic evaluation, and no psych test with a healthcare professional interpretation report by administrative technician. The insurance company declined to pay for it and was sent to ML for payment. The Special Investigations Coordinator called and spoke to Director of Operations of Mental Health Neuropsychology, and I'm not sure if I can say that the employee's name, but the coordinator was told, the investigation coordinator said that it was incorrectly billed, but it was a consultation, and there's a disagreement. Apparently, it was like the member did indeed receive services because she met with Dr. Denbor, but when you look at the actual evaluation, if you want to call it that, basically, she said, I'm in the wrong place. Yeah, I have these symptoms. And he said, well, it sounds like you need to go see a neurologist, and there's billing for that. So that sounds really questionable to me. Then another one. Go ahead.
All right, I was just going to thank you. Give another short example.
There is another one. That's very long. I won't give all. There is one on page 932 in the case involving FW. He had 25 visits. It's discussed also on PADM 2688-2689. Basically, he was not diagnosed with any kind of memory problem, but in spite of that, he was put in the program, I guess, apparently to be diagnosed with normal cognitive aging. But the rationale, I guess, was to be a preventative program. There were a number of errors in the evaluations that were copied and pasted from one to another. And it's unclear how the individual could need neuropsych exams every 8 weeks and more testing every 8 weeks with basically no diagnosis. And then a lot of services being offered. Those were the two. There were many others that I don't know that we want to go be here the entire night.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Flowers.
And I think if you look, if we had all night, we could look at them all. There are many concerning issues, but those are a couple of many.
All right. Thank you. Are there any further comments or questions from the board?
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Michelson. May I clarify one point?
Yes.
I just wanted to clarify that Blue Cross Blue Shield's audit was completed, and they did send a letter to Dr. Dunbar in July of 2019. It was a final determination letter regarding the results of their audit and the refund check that they requested. And for the member's reference, that is page 1239 in the file.
Thank you. All right, any other comments from our board members?
Ms. Shreve, this is Dr. Denbor. May I make a comment on what Dr. Flowers had said?
Yes.
Okay. Regarding the first point that he asserted, I remember that case very well. This individual did not express to me or any member of our staff that they were there, that they were in the wrong place. In fact, they came in, they signed an entire informed consent process. They gave us all the information that we normally do, and we received a referral from a doctor that typically refers to us for neuropsych evaluation. I think that's all documented. I saw the individual in the room, and approximately 10 to 15 minutes into the evaluation, they indicated that they thought they were in the wrong place. Never did I say, or never have I ever said in my career, that the person should go forward with an evaluation just because insurance would pay for it. I don't believe that that's a true statement whatsoever. At that point, I concluded the evaluation. I submitted the documentation. I had no instruction to bill this evaluation whatsoever. It should not have been a billable evaluation, and apparently a mistake was made in billing this evaluation, and that was then rescinded. So there was no actual billing, or in the finality, there was no billing of this patient.
All right. Thank you. All right, board members, any other comments or questions of Dr. Dunbar? Any discussion or on this case in regards to what direction we try to go to?
I think we should just go to a motion.
We would need a finding of fact.
And that would depend on what the motion is.
That would depend on the motion. Do we feel there is any violation? If so, then we would need to make a finding of fact. If we feel there's no violation, then the motion would be that we dismiss the case.
Okay, Madam Chair?
Yes?
Yes, I believe there are some findings of fact.
So you're right, Dr. Flowers, the finding of facts, please.
Okay. Recommending services for our clients without a diagnosis that requires medical treatment. reports that do not meet the minimum standards of care as far as accuracy.
Okay.
And I think billing for services that were not provided. Inadequate documentation for their billing.
And documentation? All right, so we have three findings of facts. Is that a motion? Is there anyone want to make a motion with regards to those finding facts? Dr. Flowers?
I'll make that motion, the ones I mentioned. I know of course other board members have others they want to add.
Are there any other comments? If not, is there a second to these finding of facts?
Seconded.
If there's not a second, okay, there's a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. With that, the violations. The violations that were with this informal interview were ARS 322061-16A, obtaining a fee by fraud or misrepresentation, C, making or using statements of a character tending to deceive or mislead, E, gross negligence in the practice of psychology, H, failing to refuse or maintain adequate records, financial and professional records, O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional like current standards, and D, violating ethical standards, particularly to 6.04 fees and financial arrangements. Those are what were initially on the informal interview notice. Are there any that you feel are applicable?
I feel that they all are.
Any other comments from board members?
Nope.
Okay. Is there a motion then for the statute that I just read? Is that what you feel, Dr. Flowers?
Yes, I make a motion that the violations you mentioned go forward.
All right, we have a motion. And is there a second?
Seconded.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
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 All right, the motion moves. All right, how are we doing? It's now 6:30. We have one more.
I have to leave at this point.
Okay, I am concerned about a quorum, making sure we have enough people. How would everyone feel about taking the last one and moving it to the next meeting? Is anybody opposed to that?
No.
Hearing none? Okay, hearing none, we're going to then do that. But we'll real quickly, because we have some students that are need our approval on something, we need to move to item number, Executive Director, help me out, I can't find my agenda in front of me. Item number 21, can you briefly update everybody on that?
Are we excused?
Yes, you are.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thanks. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Board meeting. Dr. Gillett, I need to be excused also.
Okay, Dr. Gillett, who else?
I need a quorum, so we need to talk about this issue. So do I have a quorum?
It looks like Davey is there, Flowers. Meyer, are you still sitting in there?
I'm still here. I've got a couple minutes.
Okay, all I need is a couple minutes.
Ramona? We have five. Do we have six?
We got six. Is that good?
Davey, Meyer, Ramona. Is Davis Wilson?
Yep.
We don't have a
No, we do. We have me. Dr. Flowers, Bohansky, Malott, Davies, Myers, and Diana, Davis Wilson. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Is that enough? Is 7 enough?
I don't hear Diana.
I can see her phone.
Dr. Davis Wilson? I see your phone.
She's muted.
And Dr. Gill.
Okay, just really quick. Dr. Gill, too. Thank you. Executive Director, quickly.
Yes, Madam Chair. We need a motion from this board to expand the time frame that you approved at last meeting for the Argosy students. We have some outliers, and Kathy has identified those dates as the motion reflects a start date of March 1, 2019 through March 31, 2021. That should cover the outliers.
All right.
So moved.
All right, we have a motion and second. All
seconded
favor.
By Brian.
Thank you. All in favor? Aye.
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 All right, and Dr. Davis Wilson is the last item. Do we need to take that now? That's item 22. I don't hear her, so.
Where she texts me that she is on, but for some reason we cannot hear her, so I'm not sure what the issue is.
I don't know what that issue on 20 sheet is.
Not muted.
I am unmuted on my end. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, you can hear everybody. Put your phone on mute, except for Dr. Davis Wilson. Dr. Davis Wilson, it's all yours.
Excellent. So I'll make this very brief. We have provided a memo for your review, but basically what has happened is that our National Certifying Board has issued guidance to allow for supervisees to forego observations with clients in situations in which they may not be working with clients due to COVID-19. We are requesting to mirror that and allow for students to continue to accrue the hours that are already approved in our rules for unrestricted activities that are allowable without clients, so that they are able to still continue with their training program while they're, you know, not able to see clients due to the state of emergency.
Ms. Davis,
up to and including only through the state of emergency.
Correct. To clarify, CACB has stated that it would be only allowable during the state of emergency, and it is only allowable if the supervisor attests to the fact that a client was not available. So it would not be something that everyone would be able to uniformly just forego those observations. It would be circumstances in which individuals may not have direct contact with actual patients or clients or students, but they may be still doing additional data analysis, program writing, additional things that still fall within their training program.
All right. Do you have a motion? Oh, go ahead. Is there a question? Okay. Is there a motion that you need us to approve?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would make a motion to go ahead and approve a waiver that would allow for those students to mirror the BACB requirements, that if they do not have access to a client, that they would still be eligible to accrue unrestricted hours.
All right, we have a motion. Is there Dr. Malott?
Dr. Davy will second that.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Davy. Yeah, Dr. Malott.
My question is, what is the requirement for direct service hours?
Madam Chair, Dr. Malott, the requirement right now is that direct service hours do need 50% of the supervised experience. And so the supervised experience is 1,500 hours, and the maximum that a student can, the maximum they can accrue is 750, which means their other 750 hours actually have to be in the other categories. So I think that's kind of why they've allowed for some of that leeway, is because half of the hours actually need to be in a different category anyway, with a maximum of 750 being direct with the client.
So will it be possible that, say, if the situation continues, that somebody may not have any direct service?
Madam Chair, that is actually possible, or Madam Chair, Dr. Malott, that's actually possible now because the requirement is a maximum for direct care. There is no maximum or minimum set for the unrestricted hours. So someone could theoretically do 1,500 hours of unrestricted activities. Now, having said that, there would be scope of practice issues should they then go into working with clients. But as it stands now, the rule is just set for the direct care. Now, keeping in mind that the nature of our services are a little bit unique in that sometimes a large majority of what we're doing is actually training staff members. So we may be in schools training teachers or training paraprofessionals and not directly necessarily working with individual patients. And so it is entirely possible that some of those unrestricted hours could come in the form of parent coaching or parent training, or could come in the form of training staff members as well.
All right. So any further questions or comments? All right. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? All right. The motion carries. I just want to thank everybody so much for hanging in all day long. This has been an incredibly long but productive meeting. And staff, thank you for setting this up. Ms. Galvin, thank you for all your wonderful advice. And I hope you all go have a really relaxing evening. But before we end, we're going to make a motion to end. Mm-hmm.
Second.
All right.
Thank you.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. All right. Good night.